This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Dr. Ian Malcolm tried to warn us. Don't you see the danger inherent in what you're doing here? Genetic power is the most awesome force ever seen on this planet, but you wield it like a kid who's found his dad's gun. The problem with scientific power you used is it didn't require any discipline to attain it. You read what others had done, and you took the next step. You didn't earn the knowledge yourselves, so you don't take the responsibility for it. You stood on the shoulders of geniuses to accomplish something as fast as you could. Your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could that they didn't stop to think if they should. Scientists can create pesticides, but it can't tell us not to use them. Science can make a nuclear reactor, but it can't tell us not to build it. That warning from Jeff Goldblum's character in Jurassic Park framed a saga that millions fell in love with 25 years ago, myself included. The latest film about the decimated theme park debuts tomorrow, and on its Silver Jubilee, we're going to talk less about science fiction and deal more with science fact. Science is key to the franchise, our quest to recreate prehistoric beings. The famed paleontologist Dr. Jack Horner served as a longtime advisor on Jurassic Park. Now, he says human-made dinosaurs might not be too far off. Just how far off might they be? And, to answer Dr. Malcolm's question, if we could bring them back, should we? That's just ahead on 1A. Stay close.
Support for NPR and the following message come from U.S. Army Medicine, one of the nation's innovative medical institutions that puts healthcare professionals at the forefront of medicine. U.S. Army Medicine is an elite team pioneering new medical discoveries to make a difference in the lives of Americans. Army Medicine is your chance to push medicine further. Learn more at goarmy.com/amed.
NPR's Rough Translation is like your best travel experience. It takes you someplace new, and it leaves you with a fresh perspective on home. This season, we follow the go-betweens, people trying to cross a cultural bridge or change the culture they know. Check out Rough Translation wherever you get your podcasts.
Joining us from the BBC in Edinburgh, Scotland, is Steve Brusati, a paleontologist at the University of Edinburgh and the author of the new book, The Rise and Fall of the Dinosaurs, The Untold Story of a Lost World. Steve, welcome to 1A.
Hello from Edinburgh.
Joining us from the BBC in London is Dr. Adam Rutherford, a former geneticist, now a science writer and broadcaster. We last spoke to him about his book, A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived, The Human Story Retold Through Our Genes. Adam, welcome back.
Hi, Joshua. Nice to talk to you.
Steve Brusati, I believe that you are a Jurassic Park geek as well. Did the movie help to get you into paleontology?
I love Jurassic Park. It was a film that was really, really instrumental to me. I still remember seeing it in the cinema when it came out in 1993, the summer blockbuster. I was 9 years old, and I went to see it with my dad and with my brothers. And I loved it, but I have to say it didn't immediately inspire me to become a paleontologist. But for my youngest brother, Chris, he became obsessed with dinosaurs. He turned his bedroom into a dinosaur museum. He compiled a library of hundreds of dinosaur books. And it was really through Chris that I became eventually enthused with dinosaurs when I was in high school. So I love the film. I think a lot of other paleontologists of my generation, women and men all over the world, were turned on to dinosaurs 25 years ago by that film. And I think really it's probably the most important thing that has ever happened into the science of paleontology, because so many new jobs, so much funding came directly because of the film.
Yeah, I do want to talk to you more about how the films affected paleontology, but Adam Rutherford, out of curiosity, what about you? Did Jurassic Park have anything to do with your interest in dinosaurs?
Well, I'm a bit older than Steve, and so I was already at university when it came out. I think it was 93. Mm-hmm. And I was studying evolutionary biology and genetics, so one module of which was to do with paleontology. And I love Jurassic Park too. And in fact, there's that key scene where Sam Neill and Laura Dern see the, I think they're brontosauruses, are they, Steve?
I'll forgive you, Adam.
When they see them for the first time and they get out, they sort of stumble out of the car, and he pulls his glasses off, and that was me in the cinema. That was, that was Sam Neill being all of us just going, holy smoke. This is what I've been waiting for since I was, I don't know, four.
Yeah, that's that scene where I think it's Richard Attenborough says, welcome to Jurassic Park for the first time. And then it's that vista. I wonder, Steve, with the flip side of science fiction movies. I mean, it is fiction, but it has to be rooted in science. And it turns out that for some of our listeners, you can love and appreciate Jurassic Park, but also be a bit of a critic when it comes to its portrayal of dinosaurs. Here is how one listener put it in a voicemail in our inbox.
This is Allison calling from Rockville. I want to say in the future that I really wish they would have more dinosaurs with feathers and different colors because of the amazing fossil evidence that's been coming out since the movie came out. So I'd like to see more realistic dinosaurs to the best of their ability.
Allison, thank you for calling in with that. Steve, I wonder how much that does become the double-edged sword of Jurassic Park, especially because the new movies do deal with tinkering with dinosaurs, creating new ones, but you don't see a lot of bird-like dinosaurs in the films.
I agree with Allison there. I would love to see feathers on at least some of the dinosaurs. I would love to see a greater diversity of colors because, believe it or not, we can actually tell the colors of dinosaurs nowadays. But these are things that in the original Jurassic Park film, it made sense that there were no dinosaurs with feathers. It made sense that they were all green and brown and scaly because back then in 1993, nobody had ever found a feathered dinosaur. Nobody knew how to tell the color of dinosaurs. All of that came afterwards. And in fact, a lot of that research, I have to say, was inspired by Jurassic Park. It was conducted by this new generation of scientists. And right now we are in this golden age of paleontology. That's the story I tell in the new book, The Rise and Fall of the Dinosaurs. And it really is a post-Jurassic Park world now where we're learning so much more about dinosaurs at an incredible pace. A new species is being found every single week. And I do wish
you said new species are being found every week?
Every week. Once a week on average right now, somebody around the world is discovering a new species of dinosaur. 50-some new species a year. And that pace has been going on for about a decade now. And believe me, this is all Jurassic Park. This is all the new generation. This is all young scientists around the world, but particularly in China and Brazil and Argentina, in these enormous developing countries that are building more universities, more museums. You have many people, young people, women and men going out finding dinosaurs. So the field is moving so fast. I've attempted to capture that in the new book, but it's moving so fast that we're playing catch up a little bit. And I do wish, and I'm not going to nitpick too much because I love the films and I don't want to sound like comic book guy here nitpicking every little aspect of how the dinosaurs are incorrect, but I would love to see at least some feathers because to me, we now know these dinosaurs, so many of them were covered in feathers, so it just looks weird to me that they're still green and scaly.
Yeah, maybe Universal Pictures doesn't think they look quite as scary if they have feathers. Maybe they look a little more intimidating if they have scales. Let me get to a few of your comments. Stacy tweeted, "Bringing dinosaurs back to life is literally all I've wanted since I was 8 years old." Benjamin tweeted, 1A talking about dinosaurs is exactly what I needed today. You're welcome. And Michael writes, Jurassic Park introduced me to philosophy from Jeff Goldblum's character. Adam, I did want to ask you about the genetics behind the science of understanding dinosaurs. The movie came out 25 years ago, June of 1993. Give us a sense of how much the field of genetics has leaped forward since then. It's a big part of how we know more about dinosaurs today, right?
It's sort of like a different era, the 90s, compared to what we know about genetics today. So this is a time where the Human Genome Project has actually only just really started officially in 93, and then it finishes sort of 2001 in the first few years of the 21st century. Even since then, our knowledge of genetics has just sort of exploded, just absolutely transformed our understanding of, well, life on Earth in general. So this is a really hard conversation for me because I love Jurassic Park so much and I love genetics. And this is a fusion of two of my favorite things for the whole of my life. And I've got to be the party pooper about this. It's just what happens in the film is not only not plausible then, it's not plausible now either.
Steve, I wonder if you can speak to what we're learning today in terms of where in the world our study of paleontology is the richest. We just got back from Utah. I wonder if there are parts of the country or the world that stand out as especially rich places to dig for dinosaurs, to learn about fossils.
Yes. So there are some parts of the world where dinosaurs have been known for a long time, out in places like Utah, Montana, in the Hell Creek Formation that Karna was talking about, places in England as well. But what's really amazing over the last few decades is that dinosaur research, paleontology, these things have become global sciences, and people are finding dinosaurs all over the world now. There's dinosaurs from Antarctica. There's dinosaurs north of the Arctic Circle in Alaska. There's dinosaurs from New Zealand. We're even finding them here in Scotland. I'm just back from a fieldwork trip on the Isle of Skye. I took my team out last week, and we found something pretty incredible, and that we showed on CBS this morning. It's a new dinosaur specimen, it looks like, and we're finding lots of footprints there. So even on these remote islands off the coast of Scotland, it's become a global thing. We're finding dinosaurs in lots of places, and each new fossil is a clue. I really do see us as detectives of a sort, and each time we find a bone, a tooth, a skeleton, a footprint, it tells us something new about these creatures, and I am completely with you. I think these are the most awesome creatures that have ever lived in the history of the Earth. If you go to a museum, you stand underneath the skeleton of a T-Rex, let's say, you look up at that animal, a bus-sized creature, weighed 7 or 8 tons, a head the size of a bathtub, 50-some railroad spike teeth in its head, and those pathetic little arms, I think this is a more fantastic creature than any dragon or unicorn or sea serpent or anything humans have ever invented in myths or legends. But dinosaurs were real. They were real. We can find their bones, and we're learning so much more about them.
I think you're trying to get me hate mail from Game of Thrones fans, personally. I don't know what you're doing to me, Steve. Please do not send us your angry mail. You can send it to Steve. We will post his Twitter handle. But to the point about dinosaurs being everywhere, I understand that you have some pushback to the argument that dinosaurs were evolutionary failures. You know, Ian Malcolm in the first Jurassic Park movie responds to Hammond by saying, you know, dinosaurs had their shot, nature selected them for extinction. Does the geographic distribution of dinosaurs tell you anything about the extinction, as opposed to them just kind of being in the wrong place when the right asteroid hit at the wrong time?
Joshua, let me tell you, and I had the same conversation with Adam when we did Inside Science last month. You know, this idea that dinosaurs are evolutionary failures, I'm a pretty congenial guy most of the time, but if you want to get me upset, use the word dinosaur as an insult, because that's the way it used to be. That's what it was like in the books I read as a kid, this image of dinosaurs as these dim-witted, slow-moving, sluggish losers, basically, these things that were just sitting around waiting to go extinct. But we now know that's the exact opposite of what dinosaurs were. Dinosaurs were an empire. And it sounds a bit cliched, but you brought up Game of Thrones, so I'll go with the analogy. the rise and fall of the dinosaurs, it's the story I tell in the book. It is an amazing story to me. This is a story of the gradual rising up of dinosaurs. They had to best their early rivals, crocodiles and giant car-sized salamanders, on this battlefield of the super continent Pangaea. They had to dodge mass extinctions, and then they finally rose to the top, and for 150 some million years they were the dominant creatures on Earth. Some of them grew to the size of Boeing 737 aircrafts, believe it or not. Others got tiny and grew feathers and wings and turned into birds. And then, very suddenly, when they were at the top of their game 66 million years ago, this 6-mile-wide asteroid falls out of the sky one Thursday, let's say, and, traveling faster than a speeding bullet. It hit with the force of over 1 billion nuclear bombs. It smashed into the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico, not too far from where Cancun is now, and it punched a hole in the crust over 100 miles wide and 20 miles deep. And instantaneously, that triggered catastrophe. Earthquakes, wildfires, hurricane-force winds, volcanic eruptions. It reshaped the whole world within an instant, and the dinosaurs couldn't cope. They had been on top for so long. They were the dominant species. T-Rex was there. Triceratops was there. But they couldn't deal with that sudden moment of climate and environmental change, and the age of dinosaurs ended in a bang. But a few birds did make it through, and they still leave a mark on our world today. So I think there's a bit of a Game of Thrones vibe in there, but it actually really happened.
Adam, I do want to talk to you about that genetic link between dinosaurs and birds, and really our understanding of them in just a moment. But Steve, I wanted to get a few more questions from our listeners first. Warren asked on our Facebook page, with Antarctica melting at the rate it is, how big of a chance is there to discover something that would allow us to sample the DNA of a possible finding?
Warren, good question.
Adam, I'd also like you to respond to this as well in a moment. But Steve, I'll let you answer first.
Sadly, Antarctica is melting very fast. I have colleagues here in Edinburgh who study the glaciers of Antarctica, and they go down there quite often. And the stories they're bringing back are really harrowing, actually, of how quick the ice is melting. And it is true that that melting ice is exposing rock, bedrock, and mountains that do have dinosaur bones in that rock. But we can't find frozen dinosaurs in Antarctica, unfortunately, because back during the time the dinosaurs lived, the Earth was much warmer. There were no ice caps at the poles, so you didn't get dinosaurs freezing in Antarctica. You had them living in quite lush environments, in jungles and along lakes and rivers, and their bones were being washed into the water and buried and turned into rock. So sadly, it's not a case like, say, some of these woolly mammoths that we see in Siberia and in Alaska, which are found in permafrost or found in ice, basically just in a deep freeze. And that, I'm sure, as Adam can tell you, is where you can get DNA in some of those cases.
Yeah, Adam, would you chime in on Warren's question?
Yeah, sure. So just before the break, we were talking about how the oldest DNA that we've recovered is from types of horses, equids, which is about 700,000 years old. And there's an even older one from a type of plant called a saxifrage. But these are organisms that have died in exactly the right situation, and they've been buried in permafrost for hundreds of thousands of years, which is kind of like sticking a blood sample in a minus 20 degree freezer, where it's going to be, you know, in good nick for several years. The trouble is the time scale is so much further. It's several orders of magnitude greater when it comes to the Jurassic or the Cretaceous, which is more recent than the Jurassic. Which is where the dinosaurs are all from. Now, of course, in Jurassic Park, they get around this. Michael Crichton wrote this in the original. They get around this by having the DNA being extracted from a mosquito, which is embedded in amber. And it's very prescient. It's a really good way of getting around the problem of just storing DNA for that long, which we didn't even really know was an issue back in 1993 or earlier when the book was written. Still, though, I'm just going to have to be party pooper. It's just way too long. It's just far, far too long for DNA to be preserved. Even if it was preserved in the blood of a mosquito, preserved in amber, that just it's a data storage format which will not last that, you know, millions of years.
Yeah, Adam, I'd love to get a clearer understanding of why this data storage format, if we can kind of keep it in fairly simple layman's terms, why it's so hard to work with. We've gotten a few questions from some listeners, including Jet. Jet wrote on our Facebook page, DNA is not the whole story, though. Without the epigenetic marking on chromosomes, there are no blueprint instructions for assembling the building blocks of genes into the organized tissues of a complete organ or organism. Adam, it sounds like that's just one of the many challenges of getting enough genetic information with the right instructions in the right order to reverse engineer anything.
Yeah, that's exactly right. If you think of DNA, think of our genomes as being, I don't quite like instruction manual, but it's a sort of template of instructions from which a life is built. Now, we used to say nature versus nurture, but a better way of thinking about the relationship between our biology, which is our DNA, and our environment, which is everything that isn't DNA, is nature via nurture. Now, that is a complex and dynamic interaction between DNA and everything else in the universe and in your body that starts at conception and goes on through 9 months of development in the womb, if you're human, and then goes on for the 70, 80 years that you live during your life. So the analogy I've used before is that DNA is kind of like an orchestral score, but that's not the performance. It still has to be performed, and every conductor and every orchestra will perform in a slightly different way. So there is a whole ton of information which isn't necessarily available, even if you have the DNA, which we don't have for dinosaurs, and probably, I don't know, never say never, probably will never have.
I wonder if we could talk a little bit about the ethics of Jurassic Park and the ethics of understanding dinosaurs. Holly wrote on our Facebook page, "Thank you for opening with this quote," meaning the quote of Jeff Goldblum as Ian Malcolm. Holly writes, "So they're focused on whether they can do something. They never stop to ask if they should do something. Scientists should always ask themselves this question. The more we fool with genetics, the more potential for disaster." I'd love to hear from both of you, Adam and Steve, about the nature of the ethical debate that Jurassic Park involves. I feel like back in 93, it was much more theoretical, but then after Dolly the Sheep, the whole thing kind of changed. After the CRISPR genetic editing technology out of Berkeley, it just felt like, oh, this is a debate we have to have now. Adam, where do you see this debate standing? Not just with dinosaurs, although dinosaurs in particular, but with the can versus should debate with genetic information.
It's kind of the central debate within not just this conversation, but within so much of science, because, you know, science has got to be bleeding edge, or else you're not really actually doing research. If we just park dinosaurs to the side for one moment, this is a real debate because, as Steve mentioned, we've got much more recent but extinct organisms from whom we can get good quality DNA, such as woolly mammoths, because they have died in permafrost and they have been frozen for 10 or 20,000 years or even longer, and we can get good genetic information out of them. The ethical debate, I think, is the real this is the real conversation we should be having. Sorry to be so serious for just a second, but you got to, if you think about a mammoth, if you think that if we were technically capable of creating a full mammoth genome, we have a really good read of mammoth genomes, which is not perfect, but it's pretty good. If we were capable of turning that into an actual mammoth, we'd have to consider, right, you'd probably put it into an African elephant or the nearest relative, which would be a living elephant, and into a fertilized egg of one of them, and then you gestate it, and then the elephant would give birth, and you'd have a mammoth, right?
I'm sorry, I hate to interrupt, but I just want to be clear on part of the example you're giving, is that you're talking about not just putting the genetic material in a vat and letting it develop on its own. You're talking about hybridizing it by putting the genetics in the closest living, reasonable relative that exists, and then allowing a hybrid to grow into whatever it is you're trying to create.
Yeah, we're not really capable of growing organisms, complex organisms, you know, big animals like mammals in vitro, in dishes yet.
Gotcha.
So what we'd have to do is take the genetic material from the mammoth and stick it into the nearest relative, the egg of a nearest relative, which is sort of what they did with Dolly back in 97, and then implant that egg into an elephant. Now, if that were all possible, which I have severe doubts about it being possible, the amount of information that we don't know is kind of crippling and just kind of ends this conversation, because we don't know how long a mammoth gestation is. Mm-hmm. Artificial insemination in elephants does exist, and I won't go into the details, but it's
It's complicated.
And it's quite a difficult route,
right.
If that's a euphemism enough.
Right.
But even if we could do that, you've got to take on board the fact that mammoths, what we know from elephants and almost certainly about mammoths, is that these are highly intelligent social beings that have complex societal structures that we are beginning to understand, and highly complex forms of communication, which we're only really just beginning to hear. They're social animals. And if we successfully manage to recreate a mammoth, you're talking about a situation where one species is giving birth to another species, and it would be alone on Earth in an environment that it has never encountered, that it has not evolved to exist in. It would be exposed to all sorts of diseases that it hasn't evolved to respond to. I think actually this is nothing other than, well, it's cruelty. And I cannot see a way around that.
Interesting that you call it cruelty, Adam. And Steve, I do want you to respond to this. I know we have to pause in a moment, but that's kind of on the line of what Jessica wrote. Jessica tweeted, "Even if we could bring dinosaurs back, we should not. The human race cannot even take care of the amazing animals we have on this planet. We don't deserve to have dinosaurs back. Steve?
I am going to agree with Jessica. And maybe it's not what you expect me to say, because let's face it, for the last 15 years or so, I've been traveling around digging up dinosaur bones. I've spent so many months away from my wife, away from my family, in the bowels of museums, measuring and photographing dinosaur bones. I would love to see a living dinosaur. I would love to be able to test some of these ideas. Are we correct in our inferences from the bones? Could Allosaurus use its jaws like a hatchet to break the necks of its prey? How could a big long-necked dinosaur like a Brachiosaurus lay eggs and care for its young? I would love to see a herd of raptors hunting. But if there was some kind of magic button to push, I wouldn't push it, because I agree. I think it would be cruel to bring them back. First of all, they had their time. Dinosaurs had their time. They lived for a long time. And we didn't send that asteroid that wiped them out. So I think it would be hubris for us to bring them back. But secondly, and more importantly, on the ethical side of things, the dinosaurs lived in a different world. Even T-Rex, one of the most recent dinosaurs that was there on the day the asteroid hit, T-Rex lived in a world that was warmer, a world with more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It breathed different air. It ate different food. There were hardly any flowering plants back then. There were no grasslands.
Hey, Steve,
it lived with different species, it would be different.
I hate to cut you short, Steve. I want to get to the rest of your response in just a moment. We'll continue our conversation about the science of and the cultural impact of Jurassic Park. And by the way, where did the word dinosaur come from? The answer's just ahead. Stay close.
Support for 1A and the following message come from American Express. These days, keeping up with everything in the news is hard, whether it's politics or pop culture. American Express believes it's always easier to stay ahead when there's someone behind you. Easier to focus on what matters, to follow what interests you, to explore, to discover. And with American Express, you don't have to go it alone, because they have your back. Don't live life without it.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Before the break, we asked where the word dinosaur came from. Turns out we can thank English biologist Sir Richard Owen. He first used the term dinosauria back in 1842. He needed a word for a new group of animals that he had recently identified. The word comes from two Greek words, deinos, which means terrible, and sauros, which means lizard. So dinosaur means terrible lizard. Well, fans of Jurassic Park say the series is anything but terrible. There were those one or two movies in the franchise, but we'll set those aside. It still made a big impact on moviegoers and theme park lovers. Those include Jill Pantozzi, who joins us from Brooklyn. Jill is the managing editor of io9.com and the founder of thenerdybird.com. Jill, welcome to 1A.
Hey, Joshua.
I wonder what your Jurassic Park story is. Jill, did the movie have the kind of effect on you that maybe it had on Nicole?
Oh, huge impact. I saw it when I was 11, like a lot of other youngsters. At the time, I didn't realize what an impact it would have, not on just me personally, but the world. It was around the time when I had moved with my family and I was trying to make friends. And of course, being a geek, I was a little nervous that I, you know, didn't want to share that kind of thing with everybody just in case they would shun me. So Jurassic Park was very much a me thing. And I used to watch it on VHS alone on the weekends in my sleeping bag in the living room and just marvel at it.
I understand you have a Jurassic Park tattoo.
I absolutely do. It took me many years to decide what I actually wanted. You know, I said, there's the logo, but that's not really me. I finally found an amazing piece of art on Etsy by an artist named Lauren Baker. I had her change it up a little bit to make it more personally me, but it's three dinosaurs, a few flowers, and it says, "Dinosaurs eat man, woman inherits the earth."
That line from Laura Dern's character in Jurassic Park. What was that like for you the day that you decided, I'm going to get this tattoo? What did that represent in a larger sense?
You know, I'm a pop culture junkie. I've made a living out of being a geek. It's very, you know, intrinsic to who I am. And that film really, you know, was kind of like a best friend growing up when I wasn't able to share that kind of geek stuff with other kids without feeling weird about it. And it just, it was one of those movies that it was the first time I experienced it as a movie that I knew people had gotten together to make, you know. And I know that sounds a little weird, but when you're younger, you don't really think about all the behind the scenes things. And being able to see all the tremendous work that went into putting this film together, it just made it that much more important to me. And so getting that tattoo, like I said, it was a long road. And I knew for many years that I wanted it. So the day that I finally got it, I was just thrilled.
We asked for your stories of watching Jurassic Park for the very first time. Here are some of the stories you left for us by voicemail.
My name is Jessica. I'm from St. Louis, Missouri. I was about 7 years old when the first movie came out.
Hi, my name is Pat Long. I'm calling from Zionsville, Indiana.
Hi, this is Jan. I'm calling from Fort Wayne. The first Jurassic Park movie that I saw, my son was about 4 or 5 years old. He was sitting on my lap, and the first time that a dinosaur jumped out on the screen, he threw his head back real quickly and broke my nose, and blood was running down my face.
I was good throughout the entire movie, on the edge of my seat and things, but what really got me was the scene where she was flipping the power back on and the raptor burst through the wall. My dad says that he looked over and all he saw was a streak of white running up the aisle because it scared me so badly.
What I remember the most is coming out to an empty parking lot at night with nobody around and just having the feeling that any minute some big creature was going to put his foot down next to us.
Y'all make me feel much better about myself. I have to say, because I loved Jurassic Park. I love Jurassic Park. I am deathly afraid of dinosaurs as a result of Jurassic Park. I have never broken anybody's nose over this or any other motion picture.
It was scary.
Yeah, well, it is scary. I'm not going to break somebody's nose about it. What was that? I mean, and I was partly freaked out by Jurassic Park because all the men of color in Jurassic Park die. A brother gets it first. They killed Samuel L. Jackson, children. They killed Samuel L. Jackson. So of course I was scared. But I wonder, Jill, if you think that that's part of what makes the franchise so popular. To me, it's this blend of this awe, and what one listener earlier in the program described as this primordial awe, and also the fact that it was scary as hell when it came out.
It was, yeah. And I think, you know, we as an audience experience the film just like the people in the film were experiencing Jurassic Park itself. It was a revelation to us to see this sort of thing come to life on screen. It was at the time, you know, really big into CGI and blending the practical effects, which I think, you know, is very underestimated in the industry still at how much those practical effects can make this feel all the more real to the audience.
And I'm sorry, when you say practical effects, you're talking about effects that are actually performed on camera that don't require computers or other post-production effects.
Exactly. Like they had a big T-Rex. I think it was the first like quarter of the T-Rex. So when they had the two Jeeps in the rain and the T-Rex comes out, they actually did have this giant T-Rex head that the actors could play off of. And that is super helpful for the audience and the actors.
Jill, I wonder what you think of the franchise today. I mean, there have been a bunch of Jurassic Park movies, then they rebooted it as Jurassic World. The new film, Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, comes out tomorrow. Universal Studios has Jurassic Park rides at many of its, at least two of its parks. They are renovating those rides to turn them into Jurassic World rides. How far does this go? Do you think the franchise still has the steam it had, or is it running out of steam?
Oh, you know, it's tough in my position. Having grown up with it, I might have a completely different outlook than a young kid seeing those films today. You know, there's this whole sort of revival in Hollywood of nostalgia films, you know, bringing back all these franchises that people liked when they were younger, and now they're in their 30s, 40s, 50s. And it's sort of, on one hand, you know, you say, oh, it doesn't have exactly what the original did, so I don't really like it. But on the other hand, you have to think, maybe it's not exactly for me anymore. Maybe it's for this new generation, and they're going to love the heck out of it.
Steve, I'd love to hear from you on that. I mean, for me, what made Jurassic World, the first one, and what I think will make Fallen Kingdom work is the continuity with the first movie. You still have B.D. Wong, who played one of the geneticists at Jurassic Park, who kind of gives it to the new owners, like, more teeth was what you asked for. And you still have Jeff Goldblum as kind of the voice of morality in the stories, which makes it a nostalgia piece, but it grounds it in the point of the franchise. How well do you think the franchise is doing, Steve, at staying true to what made people first fall in love with it?
Well, I have seen the new film because here in the UK, where Adam and I are, it's been out for a few weeks. So I saw it a few nights ago, and I won't give anything away.
Please don't.
Other than just to say that B.D. Wong's character, my goodness, the geneticists are getting pretty evil, and they're not a good representation of Adam and the other geneticists, do I know?
We will not hold it against Adam, we promise.
But I think the film, I liked it. I think people will like it. I think the last film, the first Jurassic World film, was a great film. It was nostalgic. It was part of this move in Hollywood, it seems, to bring back a lot of these franchises. But I thought it was great entertainment, and it made a ton of money. I mean, it set box office records in 2015. So clearly, people are still really enthused about dinosaurs, and I think the films remain good entertainment. So I'm very happy with them. Of course, they're not science documentaries, but they are good summer blockbuster movies. And I'll just put in the final plug, I'll say, for the book. I've written the new book, that's The Rise and Fall of the Dinosaurs, which is really the real story of dinosaurs. There's a chapter in there on T-Rex that talks all about the real T-Rex. If you want the real story, there's so much new that's been discovered these days. You can go online, you can read these books and see the real story. But I'll just say that two nights ago when I saw it, I had a great 2 hours in the cinema.
Adam Rutherford, science writer and broadcaster for the BBC, the author of A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived. Steve Brusati, paleontologist at the University of Edinburgh. His new book is called The Rise and Fall of the Dinosaurs. And Jill Pantozzi, pop culture journalist and managing editor of io9.com. Thank you all for being with us. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.